Hey there, everyone. It is 4 o'clock in New York City. I'm Stephanie Ruhle in for Nicole Wallace. And we begin this afternoon with breaking news about the much anticipated public hearing by the January 6th Select Committee. What was set to be the committee's first in more than 2 months, well, the hearing has now been postponed in light of Hurricane Ian, which is set to impact parts of Florida starting tomorrow. The hearing, now date to be determined, was meant to be a big reset for the committee, a moment to refocus the country's attention on the deadliest attack on the U.S. Capitol in centuries and the role of the ex-president and his allies on that very attack. A key player in the next January 6th hearing, according to reports, you're looking at him right there, Trump ally and longtime confidant Roger Stone. NBC News has obtained portions of the documentary A Storm Foretold, which follows Roger Stone in the days leading up to January 6th. Clips of the documentary will reportedly be featured in the upcoming hearing. Here's Stone 4 months before the 2020 election telling an aide that Trump should reject the results.
What they're assuming is that the election will be normal. The election will not be normal. Oh, these are the California results? Sorry, we're not accepting them. We're challenging them in court. If the electors show up at the Electoral College, armed guards will throw them out. I'm the president. F*** you. You're not stealing Florida. You're not stealing Ohio. I'm challenging all of it. And the judges we're going to are judges I appointed. F*** you. You're not stealing the election.
Why was he so sure that Trump was going to lose? And here's Roger Stone after January 6th on plans for a pardon for himself and for others who were involved in plotting to overturn the election.
But how many, if you're talking about pardoning a movement, how many?
I think 132 congressmen voted with Trump. That's 132 right there. I mean, the list can be as big or small as you want, but I mean, it's a way of saying this is so you can't run your Witch Hunt 2. I mean, I'm going to do a movie poster, Witch Hunt 2, with a big picture of Merrick Garland.
So that's the concept. Has it been pitched to the president?
Yes, it has. I believe the president's for it. The obstacles are these lily-livered, weak-kneed bureaucrats in the White House counsel's office, and now they must be crushed because they've told the president something that's not true.
Lily-livered, weak-kneed. In a statement, Stone says he thinks those videos have been manipulated. But here's the thing. He has not provided a single shred of evidence to back up that claim. Preparations for the hearing come at a critical moment for the committee, with very big unanswered questions for the committee's members as they prepare to wrap its work up by the end of the year. From the New York Times, quote, the panel, whose public hearings this summer exposed substantial new details about former President Donald J. Trump's efforts to reverse the outcome of the 2020 election, must still decide whether to issue subpoenas to Mr. Trump and former VP Mike Pence. It has yet to settle on whether to enforce subpoenas issued to Republican members of Congress who have refused to cooperate with the inquiry or what legislative recommendations to make. And it must still grapple with when to turn its files over to the Justice Department, how to finish what it hopes will be a comprehensive written report, and whether to make criminal, I'm going to say it again, criminal referrals. It cannot even agree on whether Wednesday's now delayed hearing will be its last. So let's discuss. Joining us now to start off our program, New York Times Justice Department reporter Katie Benner. Also with us, Joyce Vance, former U.S. attorney, now law professor at the University of Alabama, and former Republican Congressman David Jolly. They're all MSNBC contributors and friends of this hour. Katie, I want to start with you. The hearing is now officially postponed, but what can you tell us about what the committee had planned for tomorrow? Because it's likely to be rescheduled pretty soon. They're only delaying it because of the storm.
To work off that first question, is that there were a lot of questions inside of the committee about what could happen and what they could present to the American public. There are no witnesses, for example. They weren't really sure what they should say. This has been, in some ways, a hearing that has been a debate about whether or not there should be a recap of what had happened, what the most compelling evidence is that they can show about people like Roger Stone, and basically whether or not they should even be showing evidence that takes the eye off of the ball of Donald Trump. Should they be looking at massive security failures that happened ahead of January 6th, which is something that teams of people inside of the committee have been researching. So it seemed like until today, they had settled on something that was a little bit of a mixed bag, that they would look at they would do a bit of a recap for the American public. They would hone in on people like Roger Stone, but it was not even clear whether or not this would be their last hearing.
Joyce, I am not saying it's fair or just, but a lot of people are fatigued and they're confused. Blame Donald Trump. There are so many damn investigations out there. But given these hurdles, what does the committee need to do to get people to focus and really care? This is very important stuff.
Well, first off, I think the committee made the right decision here. Living in Alabama, not too far up from the Florida-Alabama coast, our prayers obviously go out to everyone in Ian's path, and staying safe is the most important thing. So for the committee to not do anything that would impair people further was a good move. It also is an opportunity for the committee to solidify its plan for this hearing. So far, the committee has managed to deliver in each one of these hearings. They've pushed the ball forward, and they've kept the focus on the former president, which, as you point out, Steph, is very difficult to do. There are so many investigations swirling around the former president that it gets confusing. And, of course, Trump refers to that as witch hunts, right? It's just a witch hunt because there are so many investigations. In reality, what that means is there was just so much misconduct, so much wrongdoing. And this is the committee's final opportunity to present to the jury of public opinion, because their job here is the political job, not the criminal investigation. But this is their final opportunity to compel people, to compel voters on their way to the polls, whether they believe they have a direct political role like that or not, that the former president's conduct was so egregious that it disqualifies him for further service. So whether it's a recap, whether it's the presentation of new evidence, or some combination of those two, the overarching burden that this committee now carries is making sure that this former president is never returned to office.
Katie, I want to dig deeper into your reporting because it's forward-looking. You write, Representative Zoe Lofgren, Democrat of California, said the panel would focus some of its energy on ongoing threats to democracy, such as 2020 election deniers gaining power over election systems. Help us understand this, because they're not looking just at January 6th. What they're pushing forward to is showing the American public that these threats, these risks, they are ongoing. They're all over this country, whether you see it or hear it, it's happening.
Absolutely. And this is something that many members of the committee, including Zoe Lofgren, including Liz Cheney herself, have spoken about extensively, and they are very focused on. They don't want us just to see January 6th as something that happened, as the worst attack on American soil since 9/11. They want to see it as the beginning of something, as the beginning of multiple movements to undermine democracy. So they want to sort of contextualize, not only was this terrible, but that it is not yet gone. It is a problem that was born on January 6th, and that is something that we need to vanquish. And so this is an obsession for many members of this committee, Zoe Lofgren, but particularly Liz Cheney. She just was speaking at the Texas Tribune Festival in Austin over the weekend, and on Saturday night, she said multiple times, I do not think that people who deny the results of the election should be in office. She encouraged voters to make sure that those people did not control the levers of government. So this is something that she has an eye toward. It's one of the reasons why we may or may not see this as the last hearing when we do get it, because she has messages that she wants to put in front of voters between now and Election Day.
What do you think about that, David? I mean, look at states like Maryland, Pennsylvania, where you've got full-blown election deniers running for governor, people running for secretaries of state that would not necessarily protect our democracy.
It is one of the great threats to today's democracy. And it is true. It's a recognition that January 6th was almost just halftime, right? If this movement towards anti-democratic actions that get permission structure for one of today's two major parties, if that is to continue, it is a danger. I think the question is that an agenda that appropriately sits within the January 6th committee or not? Was the January 6th committee charged with investigating the events of January 6th, 2021? And I would kind of lean towards the latter, in particular because, frankly, the clock is just not on their side, Stephanie. We have 6 weeks until Election Day. The American people's mind is not always going to be focused on Donald Trump on January 6th going into November. And then coming out of November, you only have another 6 weeks, which are the holidays. And frankly, if the House switches, a wind down of the January 6th committee. I think the greatest imprint the committee can have at this point. They have presented to America the story, and I think it surprised many of us, the direct indictment of Donald Trump himself. Right. They went in each hearing, they went straight towards Donald Trump's culpability. They have delivered that message to the American people. Now is probably the time to see what are their conclusions and what do they look like in writing in a final report, and a report that likely would be relayed over to the Department of Justice, because the indictment will be damning. It is damning. We don't actually need a whole lot more than what we've already seen to understand Donald Trump's culpability for January 6th. The question of what comes next, is the American public willing to stand up and stop the next January 6th, becomes a political question for voters in November and going into 2024.
Joyce, it may be a damning indictment, but all they can do is write a report. Given that, how essential is it for them to wrap this thing up and give all of their work over to the Department of Justice, who can actually put some real consequences behind this?
So DOJ doesn't have to wait on the committee to send them a report. They're fully capable of investigating on their own. In fact, in many ways, their power is far superior to Congress's. For one thing, they can use a grand jury. They can issue subpoenas. They can enforce them to obtain witness testimony. So in many ways, these two investigations are running on parallel tracks, but ultimately making their case to different juries. Congress to the jury of public opinion, and DOJ, should they find evidence that they believe is sufficient for indictment, may well end up in a federal courtroom making their case to a jury.
But Katie, hasn't the January 6th committee said they're not going to, quote unquote, turn over all their research and work to the DOJ until they're done? That's really valuable content that the DOJ could certainly use, no?
It is valuable content, and the Justice Department could certainly use it. But I think that the committee is in a tough spot. They really want to make sure that they have the best information. They have blockbuster information. They see this as presenting to the American public, both in a written report, but as you and I both know, people do not read these written reports. How many people in the country actually sat down and read all 500 plus pages of the Mueller report? So they also feel that they want no leaks and they want no surprises. They don't want anything coming out of, you know, a back and forth between the Justice Department and the committee. So they want to present the information in what they see as the most powerful way to the American people. But again, you know, David's point on their purview and what they're supposed to be doing as a committee, that is interesting too, because there are people on the committee who say, well, part of our mission was to see what went wrong. And there are pieces of information, for example, about law enforcement failures that are just not getting play to the American people because it doesn't really work with this bigger message of Donald Trump and Republicans holding him accountable that several members think is more important. So we're also seeing a back and forth about not only the committee wanting all the information for itself so that it can have the most impactful hearings possible, some would say to the detriment of the Justice Department investigation, but also the committee debating to itself, well, what is our real mission? Is our mission to keep Donald Trump from ever holding office again? Is our mission to force Republicans to vanquish him? Or is our mission to present to the American public what happened on January 6th in its full and most complete picture, whether or not that full and complete picture actually does the work of, you know, quote unquote, stopping Donald Trump?
I want to play another clip from that Roger Stone documentary. Here's what he said before the 2020 election.
Let's just hope we're celebrating.
Yeah.
I really do suspect it'll still be up in the air. But when that happens, the key thing to do is to claim victory. Possession is 9/10 of the law. No, we won. F*** you. Sorry, over. We won. Yeah. You're wrong. F*** you.
We won, you're wrong, F you. Isn't that exactly what Donald Trump tried to do, David?
It is. And look, it's a tactic in close elections to declare victory. But I think the context of Roger Stone saying that is what is most disconcerting, right? This is also someone who pushed the election denying strategy. And also, frankly, we now know was expecting, if not encouraging, violence. What ultimately was the currency of the January 6th attempt to undermine the election, violence. This is the actor that Roger Stone is. And I think that's why he's a target of the January 6th committee's investigation, Department of Justice as well. Look, the interesting thing about this whole conversation, Stephanie, is there's another challenge for the January 6th committee. Because the scope is so broad and because the malfeasance went so far in so many different corners, What is the final message that the American people need to get out of this investigation? And is it to focus singularly on the actor of Donald Trump as the person that convened this strategy and was willing to affirm violence? And when he saw the violence, asked for a weaker security posture? Is that the message? Or is it that within today's Trump and Republican infrastructure, there's a network of people willing to do this again? That's a message that has to get delivered very soon, because 13 weeks from now, the odds are there is no January 6th committee. It's completely shut down. And we're also, as we mentioned, in the holiday season and so forth. What is the message the January 6th committee needs the American people to know so they can make a decision about the future? We're at the point. We need that message.
Okay, then to that very point, we haven't gotten that message yet. But you know what message we get every single day, David? The big lie. Over and over. And there's a new poll out of Monmouth that shows 6 in 10 Republicans believe that Biden is now president only because of fraud in the election. Is that not a sign that Donald Trump's lie has gotten through? And unfortunately, the committee's hard work hasn't.
Well, I would probably see it slightly different. I think the January 6th committee has been exceedingly effective at saying Donald Trump is uniquely responsible for the violence we saw on January 6th. Donald Trump gave aid and comfort to the election denying narrative. And it is because of Donald Trump's leadership that we do see 6 in 10 people now believing that. I think they delivered a searing indictment of Donald Trump. And we didn't know that how they were going to handle that singular issue. But we do now. Now, coming out of that, what happened? Well, he has broken down the traditional orthodoxy of the GOP and rebuilt it in his own image. And so now election denying is part of what the Republican Party is. I think the focus is a corollary to Donald Trump's personal responsibility, but it's a broader question for whether or not the country can trust the GOP in this moment. And the people to deliver that question and answer it, is the viable Democratic Party alternative to the Republicans. One is going to defend democracy and defend rights in America going forward. One will trample on it and trample on your rights. That's a political question. But the January 6th committee can issue the indictment of how we got here.
Democrats, independents, and some more traditional Republicans are hearing that January 6th message and standing up for democracy, while Trump's hardcore base, though it's smaller, is standing close to him. Katie Benner, thank you for starting us off. Joyce and David, you are sticking around. When we come back, former Chief of Staff Mark Meadows due in court today after receiving a subpoena for his testimony in front of a grand jury. His potential legal peril next. And oh, the irony. The top law enforcement officer in Texas, Attorney General Ken Paxton, fleeing his home to avoid a subpoena over his state's abortion ban. Yes, the very same Ken Paxton who has sought to block women in Texas from trying to leave the state to get access to abortion. What's he doing? Sneaking out on his own, his wife driving the truck. And later in the hour, millions in Florida have just a few short hours to finish preparing for Hurricane Ian as it barrels towards their western coast. A full forecast later on. Don't go anywhere. You're watching Deadline White House.
It was a time of pride for the gay community.
I felt like I was part of a movement to liberate ourselves.
Then came a mysterious and devastating disease.
The latest figures from Los Angeles County.
We were describing evidence of a new acquired immune deficiency syndrome.
This is a story of strength and resilience.
This is our deciding moment. Together, we are greater than AIDS.
Commitment to life. Sunday, April 28th at 9 p.m. Eastern on MSNBC and streaming now on Peacock.
Today is the day for Donald Trump's former chief of staff, Mark Meadows, in Fulton County, Georgia. He was ordered to appear before a grand jury there, one investigating efforts to overturn that state's 2020 election results. Although we should note, we do not know for sure if he even showed up today. This is a state-level investigation separate from what the Justice Department is doing, but no less important. Undoubtedly of interest for that grand jury this afternoon, a now infamous phone call between Trump and Georgia elections officials where he made this now very famous
request. All I want to do is this. I just want to find 11,780 votes, which is one more than we have, because we won the state. So what are we going to do here, folks? I only need 11,000 votes, fellas. I need 11,000 votes. Give me a break.
All I need is 11,780 votes. No problem. That sounds legal. Joining us now to discuss, NBC News correspondent Blaine Alexander, who has been outside that courthouse in Atlanta all day. Joyce and David still with us. Blaine, you have been there all day. Any sign of Meadows?
The short answer to that, Steph, is no. We have not seen him. We've been watching this entrance and two others, and we have not seen any sign of him going in. It is worth noting that there is a private entrance, a kind of side entrance in which cars can go underground. That's the entrance that most of the witnesses up to this point have been using. And so if he were to go in, that's certainly the entrance that he likely used. But again, this is a grand jury process, so it's secretive by definition. So there's no way of confirming whether or not he actually appeared before a grand jury today. What we do know, however, is what the DA was hoping to hear from him. And there are several things. Of course, that phone call that you just played, that's chief among them, because we know that not only was Mark Meadows on the phone call that day, he actually spoke up several times during the course of that more than an hour long phone call. And the DA has said in her public filings that she wants to hear not only about that phone call, but she wants to hear about the conversations that led up to setting it up, the conversations around the phone call as to why exactly it was set up in the first place. And the DA has told me, as she said a number of times, that she really wants to hear from anybody who had any sort of insight into the former president's mindset, into his thoughts around any alleged efforts to overturn the election here in Georgia. And certainly Mark Meadows, as the former president's chief of staff at the time, would fit that bill. Now, there are a couple of other things that she wants to hear about, too. It's something that's talked about less than the phone call, but certainly bears investigating as well. And that's a trip that Mark Meadows made down to Georgia, to Cobb County specifically, and visited a place where there was an audit of some absentee ballots. He showed up. It was an unannounced visit, according to those filings. And essentially, he asked to be let into that process and to get access to those ballots. He was denied, of course, because it wasn't a public meeting or a public audit, but that's something that the DA wants to ask about as well, along with allegations that he made to the Justice Department, asking the DOJ to look into allegations of election fraud here in Georgia. Steph.
Joyce, let's say Mark Meadows didn't show up today. If and what are the consequences? I know if I didn't show up, there'd likely be U.S. Marshals standing at my door waiting to cuff me.
Well, it really depends on a couple of things here, Steph. It depends upon whether his lawyer coordinated with the district attorney's office in advance. I wouldn't be too quick to assume he didn't testify. Prosecutors are notorious for getting their grand jury witnesses in and out with privacy and without much public hoopla. The interesting issue for Meadows here is that if he is in fact being treated more as a witness than as a potential subject or target of this investigation, then he's very fortunate because his behavior was awfully close to the former president. It's possible that he could be characterized as a co-conspirator if ultimately Fulton County District Attorney Fani Willis decides that there's sufficient evidence to go ahead and indict. So his lawyers would have likely counseled him if he had that opportunity to show up as a cooperative witness to do so. If he didn't show up, and if it's a worst case scenario where he didn't show up without any notice, then he might ultimately change his status and the way prosecutors view his role in these events.
Blaine, we also understand that Fani Willis intends to put a hiatus on this investigation as the midterm elections start up. What can you tell us about that?
Steph, we're looking at just a little over a week before that takes effect. So it's something that she's been very clear about all along, that she doesn't want to give any sort of appearance of influencing the election in any way. She stopped back in the primaries, and she's going to do that again as we get closer to November. In fact, October 7th, that's the date that we're looking at. Here in the state of Georgia, it's the first day that voters can begin to cast absentee ballots. It's also the day that Fani Willis has said that she's going to stop all activity. So that means we're not going to see any subpoenas. We're not going to see any activity around the grand jury, and it's going to stay on recess likely until the end of the election. And then if there are any runoffs here in Georgia, likely until sometime after that. Now, there is another timeline that she's kind of put forth, though, is that she says that she hopes to, in her words, send the grand jury on its way by the end of this year, by the end of 2022. So that's saying that she hopes to have all of this wrapped up by the end of the year. Now, when we kind of look at those two, it gives a very short runway to get in several more witnesses. She said just last week that she's only heard from about 65% of the people that she hopes to hear from. So we certainly know that there are more witnesses to come forth and testify, Steph.
What could the political implications be, David? She puts this investigation on hold. Let's say Republicans win a whole bunch of these state races. Could that put this investigation in peril on the other side?
I don't think so, because the Georgia investigation, and Joyce certainly could comment on this, is one of the purer investigations, right? You actually have on audio tape the conversation, and it's a determination of law and fact. Was Donald Trump illegally trying to influence or tamper with the results of the Georgia election? That's a question of law, and I think there's ample evidence there. What I find intriguing about the Mark Meadows narrative, and I say this broadly even past Georgia, I do think the Mark Meadows story is one of the more intriguing subplots right now because he's largely gone dark. We hear very little from him. And that started about the time the January 6th enforcement mechanisms against Steve Bannon's and others started ramping up. Mark Meadows, I think, in a very risk-averse way, has realized, I need to play this exactly right. And in particular, here's why, Stephanie. Mark Short, Vice President Pence's chief of staff at the time, at the beginning of the summer, publicly accused Mark Meadows of trying to have it both ways, of lying during the events of January 6th, of saying to Pence and others, hey, I'm trying to settle down this election stealing, but also entertaining the Mike Lees and others of the world who were suggesting that, yes, the election was stolen. And so I'm going to give aid and comfort to the Donald Trump side of this equation. I think Mark Meadows, he has been publicly accused of having it both ways. That makes him a very hard witness not to perjure himself, because when you're surrounded by liars and thieves, some of whom are now cooperating, you have no idea what you've been accused of and when you might perjure yourself. I think the Mark Meadows storyline is a very important one right now.
Easy to lie on TV, not so easy in a court of law. Joyce, just last week, Fannie Willis told The Washington Post that the allegations are very serious. If indicted and convicted, people are facing prison sentences. You are keeping track of all of these investigations. How much of a risk is this one to Donald Trump and the people closest to him in his orbit?
So each of the investigations, including, frankly, the civil case the New York AG filed last week, carry different sorts of threats for the former president. But David makes a really good point in regards to the Georgia case. It's very direct. It's very simple. Georgia has a statute that prohibits election interference that appears to apply very squarely to this sort of situation. And the former president is captured on audio tape, and you played it. And when you listen to it, it's very easy to hear in his voice someone who is requesting that people find him votes that were not cast for him. That's perhaps why everyone hopes that Mark Meadows will testify in this case, although he has not shown inclination, at least not that we're aware of, publicly to cooperate. It would be very helpful to have testimony from someone close to the former president who could confirm that he knew he lost the election in Georgia, but was seeking these votes nonetheless.
All right. Joyce, David, I need you to stick around for this next segment. Blaine, thank you so much. When we come back, the chief law enforcement officer in the state of Texas, literally running from law enforcement, Texas Attorney General Ken Paxton, fleeing his home, jumping into a car driven by his wife. Why? To avoid being served a subpoena. It is an absolutely outrageous story, and it's absolutely true. We're going to tell you all about it right after the break. Texas top law enforcement officer has decided he doesn't like it when the law applies to him. Attorney General Ken Paxton fleeing a process server who attempted to serve him with a subpoena in a lawsuit brought by reproductive health groups looking to help women access legal abortions in states outside of Texas. According to an affidavit, the process server said Paxton fled his home to avoid the subpoena. His wife, a state senator, then, quote, got inside the truck and started it, leaving the rear door behind the driver's side open. A few minutes later, I saw Mr. Paxton ran toward the rear door behind the driver's side. I loudly called him by his name and stated that I had court documents for him. Mr. Paxton ignored me and kept heading for the truck. In response, Ken Paxton tweeted the following. It is clear that the media wants to drum up another controversy involving my work as Attorney General, so they are attacking me for having the audacity to avoid a stranger lingering outside my home and showing concern about the safety and well-being of my family. This coming from a man who has reportedly gone to court to defend a Texas law that allows perfect strangers to sue women on the suspicion that they might have had an abortion. Let's bring back Joyce and David. Joyce, let's just talk about the hypocrisy of Ken Paxton complaining about being approached after setting Texas women up to be harassed.
You know, sometimes events just leave you speechless. And I have to say that this is one of them. This is the Attorney General of the state of Texas saying that he was scared of a process server, someone he didn't know who had approached him. The process server has put forth, and there's no reason to disbelieve this, that he identified himself and indicated that he had legal papers. And Paxton, as the Attorney General of the state of Texas, has served with some frequency, understands and appreciates how this works. So what this boils down to is that Paxton, the Attorney General, the person who's supposed to be in charge and engage in oversight of Texas's criminal justice system, was afraid of facing the courts himself. And if that's not a perfect way of capturing what's going on in Texas on this abortion issue, I don't know what is.
And we should make it clear, he might not have liked this process server, but since then has not accepted the subpoena. David, here's what I need you to help us understand, the politics of Texas. Because if this isn't bad enough, this is a man, in case our audience doesn't know, who has been under indictment for securities fraud for 7 years. He is also the subject of a whistleblower investigation. And what just happened? Primary voters swept him right in. They seem to love this guy. What does that tell you about law enforcement, politics in the state of Texas?
Yeah, you're exactly right. Ken Paxton, one of the more disreputable figures in American politics today. And the only thing he didn't mention is that he actually spoke and participated in the January 6th rally, which was intended to be an insurrection against the United States. And I think it's that final piece that led him to re-election over George P. Bush, one of the younger Bush family members in Texas. Paxton labeled Bush an establishment legacy Republican and said he was the true Trump Republican. And so Texans elected him by a margin of about 2-1. And look, this little episode, as Joyce says, it kind of leaves you questioning a whole lot. But I think it's clear the figure of the person we're speaking about. You can accept a subpoena and actually still petition not to testify. You can petition that, you know, this is out of bounds. And ultimately, that's what he asked the court to do, is to squash a subpoena. And he was victorious in doing that. But to run from a process server raises a couple questions. One, did he think it was about something else? Did he know it was about this matter? Or did he think he was being approached about something else? Or why did he feel threatened? Someone that participated in a January 6th rally with a largely white crowd willing to topple democracy being approached by a process server that appears as Hispanic or at least not of white Caucasian origin. Why is he running from this man? Why doesn't he just accept the court papers and say, hey, I'm the top lawyer in the state. I can handle this. I'm smart enough to handle this. Look, Ken Paxton, he's a bad guy. I mean, let's just be honest. Indictment. He's been accused of bribery by people within his own office. He participated in January 6th and he ran from a process server. Sometimes you just got to call it like it is. Paxton's a bad guy.
All right. Well, then let's put Ken Paxton over there and help us understand, David. I know we give you the hard job. Where do Republicans stand on abortion? Because now we're seeing some Texas House Republicans saying they may need to soften their laws on abortion. We're hearing that on the very same day, Doug Mastriano, who is running for governor of Pennsylvania, he's now saying women should be charged for murder, women who pursue abortions. So where is the GOP on this?
Nationally, the GOP is out of step with where the American people are. And people who are in charge of Republican electioneering know that in a post-Dobbs world, they might lose races they otherwise would have won. So Republicans are worse off politically in a post-Dobbs world. Now, as you interpret those numbers where you see Democrats getting 3, 4, 5, even a bump of 6 points in some key races, what do Republicans have to wrestle with? And I think it comes down to the fact, Stephanie, you and I have discussed, the country somewhat naively often put themselves in pro-life or pro-choice camps until the Dobbs decision. And now you're seeing you're either pro-Roe or not. And you're seeing a lot of pro-life, traditionally performing Republican voters say, wait a minute, I really was pro-Roe. And now the Republican Party is anti-Roe and taking it even further. The Republican Party is out of step on this issue. It is hurting them politically. The question is the consensus within the party willing to approach the Roe framework as a future of the abortion and reproductive health question in America? It doesn't appear so. And frankly, that creates a significant opportunity for Democrats this cycle and next.
Joyce, today it was reported that the governor of Oklahoma told a rape survivor that the law in the state, which is very restrictive, can be softened after it was signed. Why on earth would they soften it? They just made a move to make it so restrictive. And who would believe them?
It's such a hypocritical thing to say. It's patronizing and it's pandering, and women and actually no one else in our society should be deceived by this. The real problem is that Republicans had been chasing the car. They were like the dog running after the car that was Roe versus Wade for close to 50 years, trying to catch it and overturn it. And now that they've caught that car, they don't know quite what to do, because the repercussions of reversing Roe, of having Dobbs become the law of the land, have political implications that they're not ready to face. And so we see these sort of catcalls here, really saying, well, we can soften it. We don't have to make it as bad as we said it would be. At the same time that Republicans in other states are trying to push this to the outer extent of Dobbs, which permits in some cases absolutely cutting off pregnant people's access to abortion, whether they need it for medical purposes or whether it's elective, simply putting it off the table. And so I think the bottom line here is that this is a form of deception that's unworthy of our politicians. When laws are passed, those are the laws of the land. There's no guarantee that they will be strengthened or weakened. They are simply the law, and Republicans should be forced to face the consequences of those decisions.
All right, then, David, before we go, I'm going to gift our audience the world's dumbest question. Why did Republicans do it? Right? The overturning of Roe v. Wade kind of came as a surprise in the dark of night. They didn't have to. They could have ridden inflation straight through these midterms. Why do this at all? All it seems to have done is given them a mountain of problems.
Look, coming out of the 80s and certainly through the 90s, Republicans made a bit of a political deal with the devil and said they would be the home of the pro-life movement. And that is a very powerful constituency, a very powerful lobbying group in D.C. And it is something that had Republicans in a post-Dobbs environment say, wait, let's go back to Roe. Frankly, they might be in a worse situation going into this election than they would otherwise. But to your point, the Dobbs case does not help Republicans going into November. They wanted to prosecute a political case against Joe Biden on the economy and some other tertiary issues. And instead, Republicans are having to wrestle with the stories around Donald Trump, with Dobbs, and with terrible Senate candidates in Georgia, Ohio, Pennsylvania, and elsewhere. This is not a good issue for Republicans. They know it. They would prefer not to talk about it, but it may be exactly what decides November.
It's a good thing you're here, David. Joyce and I are far too young to remember the 80s or the 90s. Joyce Vance, David Jolly, always good to have you here. When we come back, people across the state of Florida, as we speak, are battening down the hatches. Hurricane Ian could bump to a Category 4 storm. We'll be tracking the hurricane next.
Stay up to date on the biggest issues of the day with the MSNBC Daily Newsletter. Each morning, you'll get analysis by experts you trust, video highlights from your favorite shows.
2024 is now truly the most important election in the history of our country.
Previews of our podcasts and documentaries, plus written perspectives from the newsmakers themselves, all sent directly to your inbox each morning. Get the best of MSNBC all in one place. Sign up for MSNBC Daily at MSNBC.com.
At this time, we are expecting landfall somewhere between Fort Myers and Tampa. By the time it reaches the shores of Florida, the storm is going to slow down to approximately 5 miles per hour. And this is significant because what this means is that Floridians are going to experience the impacts from this storm for a very long time. As with any hurricane, it can still be unpredictable. This means that it is more important than ever that communities inside and outside of that projected path that you see, that you stay vigilant. And so my message to those who may be watching at home, get ready and do not underestimate the potential that this storm can bring.
That was FEMA Administrator Deanne Criswell earlier today warning Floridians to take Hurricane Ian seriously as Florida residents are bracing for what could be a huge and catastrophic storm. Forecasters say it could become a Category 4 hurricane when it hits the southwest shore tomorrow. Officials have urged residents to evacuate, calling on 2.5 million people around the state to take shelter. Hurricane Ian already slammed into Cuba today as a Category 3, producing maximum sustained winds of 125 miles an hour. Hundreds of thousands of people evacuated earlier this week after Cuba sent medical and emergency personnel to prepare ahead of the storm. Florida Governor Ron DeSantis has declared a statewide emergency. Residents on the Gulf Coast prepared by stocking up on food and sandbag homes and businesses as they prepare for major storm surges up and down the coast that could last for days. I want to bring in NBC News correspondent Ellison Barber in Tampa, who is in one of the mandatory evacuation zones there right along Old Tampa Bay. You're in the evacuation zone. Where are they sending people to go to?
So they are telling people to just get inland, right? Like, say, 20, 25 miles would be enough. There are some shelters that have been opened up in this county, Hillsborough County. There are two zones right now in just this county that are under mandatory evacuation orders. And that impacts, again, just in this county, about 300,000 people. There are nine other counties that also have evacuation orders. The word from Governor Ron DeSantis this afternoon, Stephanie, was a, hey, you don't have to go all the way to Georgia. You don't have to leave the state. Just get somewhere higher, go more inland, stay with friends if you can. Again, that being said, there are shelters, and at least in this county, they started opening those yesterday at about 2 o'clock. Where we are, we're kind of the only ones down here. It's just us and some of these ominous looking clouds that have begun to make their way towards us. This business, like many others in the area, they have closed up, done their best to sort of board up, try to prevent what they think will likely be a lot of storm surge headed in their direction. And a lot of people have actually gotten out of town. You know, this is Florida, so people are very used to hurricanes. And when we've been speaking to people, they will say, we know how to prep. We have been through this. But we've also spoken to a lot of people today who said they are evacuating, some of them for the first time in their entire lives living in this state. Listen.
I never left before. But they're showing that this one's moving kind of slow, so they're predicting a lot of water. I live in South Tampa, so it's a flood zone area, so yes.
So this one feels different.
Yes.
This one does feel a little bit different. We felt that way in the past before, so it's just better to be safe than sorry.
Personally, I've never left during a hurricane, but this time I have four dogs. I got my girl, so I'm going to go ahead and do the right thing and just get away and come back, and hopefully nothing's damaged.
The coastal geography in this area makes this part of Florida particularly susceptible to storm surge and flooding. It's a very flat, long beaches here, so it sort of is a welcome ramp, if you will, for all of that water that gets stirred up by hurricanes. In Tampa areas in particular, you also have to factor in climate change. Since the late 1940s, the sea level here has risen by about 8 inches because of climate change. Stephanie?
Does it seem like the businesses, the homes around you, people have evacuated, or at least they're hunkering down?
It does seem like that more than I expected as someone who has spent quite a few years covering hurricanes in Florida. I will say one thing that we always notice here, Stephanie, is that poorer, lower income communities, they don't tend to evacuate because it's a privilege to have the money for gas, to have the money for hotels, and sometimes those shelters aren't as accessible as maybe they should be. Stephanie?
Such an important point. Easy to say evacuate. Not everyone has somewhere to go. Ellison Barber, stay safe where you are. Thank you for the update. When we come back, the Capitol rioter who assaulted Officer Mike Fanone on January 6th, face to face with one another in court. How the judge came down on his sentencing next. Breaking news today. In a high-profile January 6th case, Kyle Young, a rioter who was convicted for assaulting Officer Michael Fanone, has been sentenced to 7 years in prison. After the hearing, Judge Amy Berman Jackson made a powerful message from the bench aimed right at former President Donald J. Trump. saying, quote, the judiciary has to make it clear it is not patriotism. It is not standing up for America to stand up for one man who knows full well that he lost instead of the Constitution he was trying to subvert. Michael Fanone was present today at the sentencing, and in an op-ed released this morning titled What My January 6th Assailant Deserves, he writes this, quote, the assault changed my life. I suffered a heart attack and a traumatic brain injury. What do I think Young deserves? Not less than 10 years in prison and an assigned cell in maximum security with his co-conspirator, Donald Trump. The words of Michael Fanone. Thank you for joining us on this Tuesday.
Here on MSNBC, we are staying on top of several fast-moving stories.
Today's news requires more facts.
A new report finds the climate crisis is getting much worse.
More context.
We are seeing record numbers of people crossing into the United States just in the southern border.
And more ground covered.
The mission will continue to carry out regime change in the Gaza Strip.
The world's never been harder to understand. That's why it's never been more important to try. MSNBC. Understand more.